I feel what diversity and inclusion has done and is trying to evolve and strengthen these groups, it will support that, because I think it'll create that touch point, those connection. I like that even before you said empathy, I think that's the one thing, is being empathetic, because we always talk about being focused on the children, our consumer. But before I've been saying this to a lot of people, it's like before we could be empathetic to, I hate to say the end user, empathetic to the consumer, we have to be empathetic amongst ourselves.
From Bright Umbrella, this is Control Clickcast. We inspect the web for you. Today, we have Vanessa Dewey on the show to talk about smashing workplace inequality with design thinking. I'm your host, Leah Alcantara, and I'm joined by my fab co-host,
Emily Lewis.
Today's episode is sponsored by Craft CMS. The Craft CMS team is excited to announce that the first release candidate for Craft 3 is right around the corner. On top of all the great features already available in the Craft 3 beta, this update will feature improvements to the control panel UI, a new concept called site groups, and more. Best of all, once it's out, Craft 3 will be considered production ready, so you can start using it for actual projects. Craft 3 RC1 will be available from craftcms.com/3. To stay in the loop about Craft 3, follow @craftcms on Twitter. This episode is also brought to you by Sidecar. Sidecar was built by the team at Focus Lab to educate and empower creative professionals. Sidecar shares industry experience that touches on subjects like best design practices, effectively communicating with clients, and more. Sidecar isn't just about teaching, but also about doing. Their digital store provides assets that help speed along the design process for a variety of needs. To learn more, head over to madebysidecar.com and use promo code CLICK20 to receive 20% off your first purchase.
Today, we continue our ongoing exploration of business culture with a discussion about how design thinking or a designer's mindset can help solve some of the challenges related to workplace inequality. We're proud to have special guest Vanessa Dewey guide us in this discussion. Vanessa is lead for development and creative experiences at Mattel, where she also serves as VP of the Women of Mattel Forum. She is also co-chair for the AIGA National In-House Initiative Steering Committee, on the board of directors for the LA Design Festival, and served on the inaugural committee for Ladies Get Paid in Los Angeles. Welcome to the show, Vanessa.
Hi, thank you. Thank you for having me today. I appreciate this. This is great. Finally can talk with you guys, because I know we've always been like ships in the night over this past, like, since Howe. So this is great. So thank you.
So Vanessa, can you tell our listeners a bit more about yourself?
Well, yeah, I've been in California, or actually Los Angeles, for 13 years. I never expected to actually live in California, let alone Los Angeles. I was born and raised in Vermont, in the area called Southern Vermont. So I grew up in and around a creative community. Bennington College was actually down the street from where I grew up. So I always was doing performing arts and visual arts and just leveraging that. I just thought that was integrated into my whole life besides academics. And for some reason, before, maybe it was like junior high school, I had to give it up and I went more academic. And so it's funny how earlier last year, I actually had a what's next moment. And I separated from my husband. I was putting a moment where I was not being creatively challenged, or projects that might have sung to me years ago weren't singing to me anymore. And it was very timely. I was talking with a girlfriend and she said to me, what was your childhood epiphany? You knew something was amazing and that you knew you could do it so well. And I actually, in that moment, had an epiphany while talking about my epiphany, because regardless if I had, it was so weird. So I actually, I guess you could say, quote unquote, career path myself back to age 4. When I was 4 years old, I wanted to go to archaeology, loved history, loved learning about cultures. At the core of it, what I loved was cultures and how within cultures you form connections that create communities. Before I went to undergrad, I was actually aspiring to go into the Foreign Service. So I majored in international relations and French at American University for a couple of years because of the same three things: culture, connections, and community. So before going back into the creative field, like, you're probably wondering, how did I get from international relations to design? But it's the same three things: culture, connections, and community. That's when I had an epiphany, I guess you could say, again, or an aha moment. And it was finishing up my general education requirements at American University. And I'm like, okay, there's something there. I took a color theory course in the design program, and the rest is history because of cultures, connections, and community. And that was like the golden thread through whatever I've done. It's funny because even when I've sort of pivoted in my career last year from branding and packaging, it still followed the same golden thread. And I was pretty shocked when I had some upper creative leaders at my company say to me, "Are you going to miss being creative?" I'm like, to me, I step back. I'm like, wait a minute. I'm not creating, you know, a package. Because I was, when I do packaging at Mattel, within like 18 months, you see your product on shelf or you see the logo someplace on a, you know, POP or commercials. But I felt because of the way I was challenging my mind, I was going to be more creative than I ever was because I was having impact on culture, especially with what my company is going through right now. It was going to be probably even more creative than I ever would expect and use my brain or that creative muscle in a way that I never would expect it. So that's a little bit of a nutshell of who I am, of how I've gotten to where I am today. One thing I can admit before we go on, people will say I do have a little addiction. It's my coffee addiction. I think a lot of people have that, but for me, it's like I've had coworkers say, "Vanessa, coffee's not water. Make sure you drink water." And it's even funny too how that falls into my golden thread of the cultures, connections, and community. Because a couple of years ago, I had to live in Hong Kong for most of January to make sure we hit some art release dates. And instead of going to touristy spots, I actually tracked out coffee shops to go to because then I got to know Hong Kong better than going to the tourist spots because I got to know the people and all. So I think it's interesting how my career has evolved, that it's almost like my external life and my internal life, I guess you could say, have sort of knitted together. And when people say, "What do you do outside of work?" I'm like, well, I still do this. And then it's just sort of bled into my corporate life at finally, like things came together. So it's exciting. It's fascinating. And I have to say, this is the happiest time I've had professionally. It's taken a long time, but the one thing I realize, you know, it's always one step at a time. So that's where I am today in development and creative experiences at Mattel.
And so you mentioned that, you know, the common threads about one of them is community. So your role has shifted, like you said, more from production type creative work to more creative community work in that role. Can you describe that a little bit and also a little bit about how that role kind of changed to have you serving on that Women of Mattel forum?
Okay. Well, I can do two questions. The Women of Mattel forum, I've been on it's the Women of Mattel. It's an employee resource group. And it's the strongest resource group, employee resource groups, or the largest one, excuse me, we have in the company. I've actually been a part of it in some capacity for at least 6 years, 7 years, maybe. Time flies out.
Oh, so it wasn't tied to your recent shift in your job. It's something you've always been
doing.
Yes,
it's always been a part of it. And it just complements what I'm doing because within my role, it's very interesting how it came to be and how I rolled into it, basically, because one thing I think that sort of led to being able to take on this role was about 5 years ago, almost. It was 2013. Me and a coworker one day realized that no outside creatives came into our company to speak. And Mattel is a creative company or a creations company. So we're like, we need to do this because we need to, you know, bring sustenance into the creatives or just the community as a whole. And we started as a grassroots project, basically. Executives sponsored it. They supported us in doing it, but they said one thing to us: let's see what we can do, but for free. You know, we got money for donuts and coffee, but we've been able to grow it. And now I've taken it over and have a nice group of like volunteers. It's all volunteer based. And we've scaled it to a point where we have it almost every other week on sub for most months. And then we had our creative conference last week, creative and innovation conference, and sort of like, if we didn't have some of these cultural elements, we wouldn't have had the creative conference. So there's a speaker series that's evolved. I have my external stuff that's evolved and they complementing each other, but also simultaneously what was going on Mattel was like many other companies that are going through the same situation is a lot of change going from what we know as the 1980s, 1990s, like marketing driven company, classic corporate company, to going more creative led. We've seen PepsiCo do that under Ingenui. We've seen that with IBM design editor Phil Gilbert, who's leading the charge down there to serve that whole transition. Our company was really going through some cultural difficulties because of just financials mm-hmm. and anything, and just the growing pains of needing to switch into a new mindset. So fortunately, I was able to be put on this task force, a small task force, I guess you could say, that reported directly to our COO. And it was all about culture. Prior to joining the team, this group of creatives that were basically non-management did like an audit of all like the 400 to 600 creatives on campus here in our headquarters to see, just to see what the issues were. And the one thing I know is like many corporate companies, we have such fast time frames and all, we just don't have time to be creative or have the ability to feel like we can leave a desk. We're just meeting numbers. We were just going very marketing driven. So I think a lot of that, when we had the answers and other elements too, played into it. So as I think also too, you can see how over that time, when we started Refuel around that same time within that ballpark, and you could just see it's how it scaled over time and how people started catching on to it over time. And then my role itself of development and creative experiences, there had been an entity maybe about 7 years ago where it was more of a genius bar just because people needed some quick fixes of help with different programs from Adobe to ZBrush, you name it. So they just want somebody there. And then there was another person who took it, scaled a little bit more, just brought in more internal type of content and programming. And then when I came into it, I was able to bring in the Refuel, bring in some of my external experience and scale it more. So I was able to actually craft the role myself. And one thing I found out was this role, like for a while, it was under our global development supply chain organization. That's where it got the support initially. But then earlier this year, about February, the COO realized that this needed to be brought into HR and to have that support, because we don't, unlike some other companies like Airbnb has this amazing entity called Ground Control that's for like more of the cultural side, or other companies that have a really robust cultural hub, like Facebook has the Analog Lab, which really helps foster the culture. We don't have anything that like any type of hub or entity. So I was brought into HR under the learning development vertical. And that's where my role has ended up, because fortunately my COO realizes now, or not now, but he's always been a champion of the culture and realizing that that's the key to fix and needed to be fixed and help us as a company, because we've heard this time and time again, without corporate culture, a company can't be creative. You need people mm-hmm. are so integral. And then what else comes in, as you mentioned, Emily, there's the women's forum. That's another component that's been evolved too. We have a very robust program for employee resource groups. We have everything from Open, which is our GLBTQ organization. We have something for African Americans, Asian Americans, veterans, parents, a seeds group, which is for all about like sustainability. So it's headed up by diversity and inclusion in HR. So fortunately now moving into 2018, one thing that's going to be happening is with my role as what I crave and development experiences, I'm going to be teaming up with for a speaker series. So whatever my speaker series is, we're going to be cross producing, cross promoting, trying to find that connection to help even foster and support the creative culture and our community here at Mattel even more so, to create more touch points and create more of a strategic direction. So to help guide people even more. So
these sort of internal groups that you've created to provide resources to different groups within the organization, is that something that you think is part of how the corporate culture can start being more human focused and more inclusive, more equal, to understand what everyone's looking for? Is that the purpose of these groups?
Yes, I think it could be multiple factors. I feel one reason why I joined the women's group initially was I needed a support system. I was a younger designer, creative, and as a woman, I just definitely felt I needed that support to help guide me and sort of point me in the right direction. I feel what diversity and inclusion has done and is trying to evolve and strengthen these groups, it will support that, because I think it'll create that touch point, those connection. I like that even before you said empathy, I think that's the one thing, is being empathetic, because we always talk about being focused on the children, our consumer, but before I always say, I've been saying this to a lot of people, it's like before we could be empathetic to, I hate to say it, the end user, empathetic to the consumer, we have to be empathetic amongst ourselves. And right. I feel that's one way, once we've provide those connections more and elevate that, I think that could help. Because at the end of the day, you know, you hear John Maeda talking about diversity and inclusion, and a lot of other design leaders talking about, you know, we need to be empathetic, or we also need to be inclusive. And diversity is so key to producing amazing product nowadays. Having diverse teams, I feel that these employee resource groups will be, if it's done correctly, and I feel under the guidance of the person who's leading it, will, it could only benefit our company in the long run.
So let's get some definitions out there for our clients so we can sort of talk maybe more abstractly so that listeners might be able to see how their own organizations, whether it's where they work or maybe it's a local community group or a nonprofit that they volunteer at, but ways that the designers in our audience might be able to take their own skill sets and try and leverage them for a more diverse, inclusive, and equal work environment. Mm-hmm. So with that in mind, what is design thinking? Like, what's a designer's mindset? Like, today's definition of that?
Oh, Lord. Yeah. When I was thinking about that, Emily, I'm just like, design thinking, it's what, 15 years since like D school and IDEO's taken on, and it's been evolved from, you know, Frog to you name it. Everybody's like, or IBM design, they're all doing their own take. So how can I say it? I feel, do you mind if I sort of just like paraphrase it and how I view it?
Please. Oh, absolutely.
More or less for me, for design thinking, I feel it's basically, it's like a methodology that provides a solution-based approach for a team to be able to solve problems. It provides a platform that allows you to be empathetic to the consumer, whoever the end user is. And I'm sorry, I keep repeating this. I'm sorry I'm using end user because I know it's almost, some people cringe when you hear that now, but it's just to provide a way to solve problems. I don't know. Like, I know my company, we are starting to integrate some type of human-centered design and design thinking into our methodology now. But when it comes to like a designer's mindset, whenever I think of it, and ever for ages, I've always just thought possessing a curiosity and open-mindedness, if you have limitations, mm-hmm. not using the limitations as something that's going to hinder you, it's going to help you, propel you to find more break frame and push the status quo, find a way around it. It's like, if you hit the speed bump, how can you get around the speed bump? It's also just being open without designer's mindset. It's also just seeing like if it's a coffee cup, but seeing it for the first time. And so that can help you find fresh and new perspective and remedies for the problem. Mm-hmm. So that's how I think of it. It's just because it's so much. It's like, and also too, now you're hearing, is design, what's next? Is design thinking over? Now is it systems thinking? And it's, so it's, there's, it's so much going on. It's like, even too, I haven't been able to read the article yet, but it's like, if everybody's doing design thinking, what's your advantage now? What's your competitive advantage? So it's, I didn't want to go too deep into the definition, but that's like, those are sort of where I, when I think of it top, just top of mind, that's where I put it.
Yeah. And I mean, Leah, I think you can speak to his best because you're the designer between the two of us. But I do think that that general definition really does describe how a lot of designers, even in the web industry, view themselves. And I do think that that definition is becoming more human with an emphasis on things like emotional intelligence and empathy and design.
Well, what's interesting, I've just been sitting back here and just absorbing all the things that you've been saying. But at the very beginning of the show, you kept mentioning cultures, connection, and community. And for me, I feel like when I think about design thinking and we're talking about human-centered approach, mm-hmm. you're really trying to connect, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And if you're trying to connect, then there's a cultural aspect and there's a community aspect. Mm-hmm. And when you have that type of perspective, that can color your thinking. I do find it really weird, though, that people like to put systems thinking and design thinking as opposing forces, mm-hmm. as opposed to complementary mindsets. Because you need systems thinking for things to actually be executed, mm-hmm. but design thinking and methodology allows you to have the proper perspective to execute the system, right?
Yes. No, that makes sense. I just remember I was like reading the, I was just going through my feed one day and just didn't have time to fully read that. But I was like, what? It was like a Fast Company article. So I haven't had a chance, but still I'm like, but especially like what, there's at least 4 to 5 different types of design thinking ideologies out there from D school all the way to right. Frog. So it's like,
right.
So,
all right. So I think, I feel like I have a good sense of that. How about the idea of workplace equality or workplace inequality? What is that defined as? you know, we're all three women speaking right now. It's not just about women's issues in the workplace. It's bigger, right?
Oh, without a doubt. This day and age, it's everything. It's from, you know, especially now with what's going on in our political culture, you know, besides gender, it's your sexuality, it's your height, your weight, your skin tone, even your accent, your race. It's just how people treat you. It's a biased behavior towards them. It's like making sure it's not like it's inequality. So even though I might be from, I'm from Vermont, but it's like, say if I'm like, I know when this is a little random, when my mother was dating my father, he was born and raised in Vermont. She was from Jersey. And because she was from Jersey, my uncle was like, was sort of treating her not the same. It was interesting. It was a little inside like family laughter, but still, you know, the fact that she was from Jersey, it wasn't the same as she was from Vermont or Massachusetts. So it's just like having that bias mentality. And even though it's very interesting, like even though it's fascinating, even women or people in general, when you don't, there's still biases we possess too. So it's fascinating. Like even in the corporate culture, when you have this such a classic hierarchical system, there's biases that if you're not a certain level above, you're not included, even though you might be a great mind to be added to the dialogue. So there's all that, especially when you come into such a traditional corporate culture. So that's, workplace inequality is very multifaceted, I think. It's not just one set direction. There's so many, I guess you could say, avenues to go down with it. It's mind-boggling. Whereas you look back at, you know, Mad Men and all, or those like shows from past decades, it's very straightforward. You're like, it's glaring, but now it's like, it's nice to see in this day and age that people are addressing it and realizing there is an issue, but we have to come to a point where we have the issue. We're discussing about how can we stop going around in circles? So,
right.
Yeah.
So how do you think that design thinking and the designer's mindset could help tackle this type of inequality?
I think one word right away with design thinking component is the empathy side, the empathetic side, without a doubt. I don't think anything else within design thinking except empathy, because, you know, imagine for me, it's like working with interns, for example, and dealing with interns and putting myself in their shoes again. Like I was there, I was that 23-year-old, 22-year-old, and never been in a corporate environment. How would they feel? What would make them help them? Like right now, for me, when I came out to LA, I knew one person in the design community. And like now, hands down, I will help anybody above and beyond because I knew how hard it was to come and break through a beast of a culture. Like LA, it's a beast. So for me, you know, it's just understanding how other people feel.
It sounds like, though, like in order to understand how people feel, you need to put yourself in a position to interact with people that don't necessarily have your experience or have had past experience that you had, but you have a changed perspective now. For example, as you mentioned, the intern, right? Like it's hard to be empathetic when you don't actually have experience with diverse people, right?
No, that's very true. I think especially even too, when you come to corporate culture where you have the hierarchical system and there's executives who've been in that role for maybe a decade or so and have not been in the boots situation. I feel with Maria Giudice, with her book, The Rise of the DEO, DEO is like the new CEO, but more of a mindset and follows that sort of the empathetic mindset. This is how I feel, is where the DEO, you roll up your sleeves and you're not going to be up on your like little golden palace or your throne. Mm-hmm. You go in with the trenches. It's being there amongst people.
Yeah, I was going to just throw in a comment. Leia, this really reminds me of our episode with Whitney Hess about humanizing the workplace, like humanizing business. And I guess what I'm hearing is that I couldn't agree more. The empathy thing just makes sense to me from a gut perspective. But I do think it's taking that, breaking down like what Vanessa was describing, an old corporate culture that was very like numbers and marketing driven, and trying to shift to think about not only your consumer as a person, but the people within the organization who contribute to that. And this type of new leadership where you're involved in it really allows you to not be, like you said, so isolated from everyone else and not even in a situation where you could practice empathy.
Yeah.
I think what I think is curious to me is I do think this is a relatively new, you know, I don't think it's like brand new. It's corporations are trying to make this shift. Mm-hmm. And even when you were describing at Mattel, Vanessa, the different types of groups that you were putting together, you know, whether it's for military families or a women's group, that they're trying to give people resources and connection. But I wonder, what about the systemic issues that sort of really support inequality, you know, like the organizational issues that are not necessarily codified, but how the business operates, you know, everything from whether it should be maternal leave to parental leave, or how pay works out amongst different genders at the organization. So the stuff that actually, I guess, the nuts and bolts of the organization versus the people of the organization.
I think a lot of it deals with just the first with the leadership, their mindset, the switching of their mindset, realizing, fortunately, I guess you could say, fortunately, in Mattel's case, we have a very new CEO. She came in February 8th, Margot Georgiadis. She was president of Google America. And fortunately, that's helping us trickle down. We have a new chief tech officer. We have a new chief people officer, new chief content officer, CFO. So I think for us in this situation, and not every company is like that, that's lucky because we're bringing new mindsets and new background perspectives to come to the table. Like our CTO, his name is Sven, and he wants to get stuff done. It's amazing. It's not the traditional way we, like most corporations, would do it. He's bringing like more of a fresher perspective. And I think that's helpful. But I think at the end of the day, I feel we can have the boots, like everybody up to middle management are on board wanting to do that. But the end of the day, it has to be championed by the executives. They have to put their mind around it, switch it. I know for a while, it's like, I've been a part of these in-house forums called the Fulcrum Forums, and they're small, like some half day symposiums. And a lot of it is centered around design thinking. And they're really nice and just like a nice spark of inspiration. Every time I came out of it, the one thing we always said was like, we had to speak their language, like executives' language, marketing. Yeah. How can we leverage, like we use our creative mindset, but speak their language. Like I had built out this deck, why a company needed chief creative officer, chief design officer. And when you speak their language, it's like, okay, here are the financial results from all these companies. We know that. Yes. So I think we at our creative conference on Thursday, our COO, Richard Dixon, did the opening keynote. And within that, he did, because we are going towards that, the human-centered design and creative-based company. And he laid it out. It's like the percentages, all the findings on a creatively led company. So he was speaking traditional corporate language, but bringing like the creative mindset to it. So I think that's the only way. Mm. We can't just say it's good. It's like, what are the ROIs? If we could switch your leadership's mindset to say why you need to change your culture, why you need to be more creative. At the end of the day, you need to show the ROIs and show how it benefits them in the long run. Because especially in corporate environments, if you are publicly traded, that's at the end of the day, it's like,
what's the bottom line?
Exactly. So,
yeah. And I think that's something Leigh and I've been talking about all year. We've been doing a series about how to talk to our clients about the work we do as creatives, but from a perspective that's going to connect with them in terms of their business. Mm-hmm. And I think that aspect of communication, I think while designers can really leverage empathy to solve things, I think it is hard to speak a different language, you know, to put your creative and human focused terms or concepts into terms that are very, like you said, bottom line based.
Well, I'm curious exactly what those ROI points are. Like, how does diversity initiatives or tackling workplace inequality impact a business in a positive way?
I could not find the statistics, but you will see a lot of studies have shown that women-led companies a lot of times outperform men in the long run. You'll see, especially when you have diverse perspectives.
Even just about the product you're just mentioning, while you gather your thoughts, this makes me think of Kellogg's last week with their Kellogg's box that had the artwork on it. Mm-hmm. That had the one corn pop that was brown and he was the janitor. Did anyone hear about this?
No.
And it was like, so there's 50 corn pops, all little corn pops at the mall doing their thing, having fun. And there's one brown corn pop. And it's like, if you had a more diverse team, that probably wouldn't have gone to market.
Yeah.
That's my gut feeling. I mean, obviously I wasn't in there. Who knows what their team was, but you know, when you have more people on the team who are sensitive to things that are sensitive to them, you know, then you can point out that maybe something might be a little tone deaf or might be a little not what you're trying to do.
Well, I actually have website and user experience example for that project that you and I kind of did, a design sprint. I was given research on the target audience and the customer base, and that the statistics on there was stated that a rising amount of customers were Hispanics. There was going to be a lot of brown people using this particular service or interacting. And it was specifically said in several points in the user experience research that they were a growing customer base. And then when I asked, as a designer, the client for the design assets like photography and samples of who these customers could be on this website, there was not one Hispanic photograph whatsoever. And it was in the research specifically said 30% of their customer base.
That's a huge market.
30% was Hispanic and growing. And it also mentioned fastest growing. And so I remember going back to the client saying, do you want me to personally find you pictures of Latin and Hispanic people to integrate into this design at least 30% of the time? And I mean, that is a business specific decision. Well, actually, it's a design specific decision with a business backing. You know, why would you want to ignore a very obvious growing sector? Would it have been different if it was not specifically race-based? But, you know, my name's Leah Alcantara. I'm not Hispanic, but I am Filipino and I am a brown person. So it was something that I thought was really striking when I was looking through the photographs.
Mm-hmm. But maybe had I been the designer, I might not have even thought of that. I mean, I hate to say that because I don't think that's right. True, but, you know, being white, right. Maybe it wouldn't have occurred to me.
Right. Mm-hmm. And the team that I was speaking to was a mix of men and women and people of color, but there was not a Latin person there. I'm not saying that we need to have the United Nations in every design team, but this just like really starkly put the fact that just having me as a person of color as part of that particular project, I was the only one. I was literally the only one that had pointed it out to them.
Yeah, I think it really underscores the importance of having, you know, whatever. I understand the definitions between diversity and inclusion. And I know some people are like, oh, no, I don't want diversity. I want inclusion, whatever. I think the more people that you have involved in a process who have different perspective on things, the better. And we talked a little bit about some positive things that can come from having a more empathetic and inclusive perspective about the business. But what's the bad stuff? I mean, what are the problems of workplace inequality? Because I think sometimes that can be even more compelling to maybe not the bottom line of like profit, but the bottom line of employee satisfaction and productivity.
Oh, no, totally. Like there's that one quote where I think I'm going to paraphrase because I've seen so many times, but it's like basically people many times leave because of their leaders leave the company.
Right.
And it's morale. Like I know mm-hmm. I've been passed over and maybe it wasn't consciously passed over for promotions or anybody has because, and you see, it's like more men are getting promotions. It's like, you see that comment. It's just, I think at the end of the day, it's morale. And if anything, and the morale then feeds into the culture. And then you have this sort of the doldrums that's in your company. And then people maybe at the end of the day are not as supportive of the company, regardless of what type of initiatives they're doing to try to right the wrongs. Still, people are become skeptical, and then they don't, it sort of feeds into the whole negativity of the culture as a whole. So I think that's the one downside. So
yeah. And I think something that's, I don't know if it's worse than not doing anything, you know, just letting things be the status quo, even if the status quo encourages inequality and people being unhappy mm-hmm. or treated unfairly. But what I can't stand in my previous life working for the man mm-hmm. was promises.
Yes.
Promises that we're going to do some stuff, mm-hmm. that things are going to get better. Mm-hmm. But when it comes down to it, it never does. You know, you have your town hall meeting and the entire company's all together and it's hoorah, we're great. And then when it comes to the actual work, no one's doing the things that they say they're doing. That is also a killer. You know, so if you're saying you're going to try and bring in speakers so that you can hear from different perspectives to help fuel your creative juices, but then you're consistently being passed over for promotions, you know, doesn't help when you're doing some things and not helping the others.
No, definitely. And I think it's having leadership as a whole saying if they're going to do something, stand up for it and say they're going to do it. But also when it doesn't happen, you've seen this. I see this a lot of companies across, you read about the leaders not coming back and saying, owning up to it and taking the accountability for it. I think that's another component of that too. I've seen time and time again from other companies I've read about and all. So that's a new wave of leadership that definitely needs to be seen more of. Even the new CEO of Uber, he was just very vulnerable. It's the vulnerability in saying that I'm afraid when he was coming into it. I forgot his first, like, was it tweet or something? But he was saying, you know, he was showing his vulnerability in one of the first communications to the public. So even if you're saying you're going to do something, and if you don't, it's just showing a vulnerable side regardless, I feel. From what you're just saying, Emily, it just makes me think of like the leaders need to show their vulnerability and not in general too. I don't know why that came out of that your comment, but just that made me think of it. So
yeah, I can understand what you're saying. I think one of the things that it's frustrating is that sort of sense of a fault. Well, it permeates our culture right now. Hey, things are great. Things are great. No, they're not. Mm-hmm. Let's acknowledge what's actually happening.
Right. You can't fix the problem until you say that there is a problem.
Exactly.
Yeah. You know, I'm curious, Vanessa, I know you have a bit of experience and knowledge about the pay gap, and I know that that's not the only issue about workplace inequality, but I did want to talk about it given what you know. So could you share a little bit for our listeners, maybe like describe what the pay gap is and what its impact is in terms of an employee's perspective, as well as what design thinking might do to help solve a problem like that, that is in every single industry, in every business, in every country in the world.
Right. Well, except Iceland.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Well, I would say more or less, because Iceland, when you see their population, it's like 350,000 women are there. So when you think of that compared to like 52% of the U.S. population on average, I think I'm just probably guesstimating at this point, is women. So I think numbers makes a difference, but they have no pay gap in Iceland. I think it was just this past year that it had to be equal pay. And then they've always been the champion. They've always been the top, like the lowest pay gap regardless for years. They have the Women's Day. So like every, was it once a year, but they haven't done it consistently every year. It's like, women would walk out of their job right when their day would start being free. And then they walk down to downtown Reykjavik. And it's a little more, I'm like, that's amazing. I wish to some degree at some company, there would be some type of like, I guess you could say,
walkout.
Like once you, or if the corporation, every woman figured out what their male equivalent was earning. And then everybody go to their HR and say, hey, you know, I want a raise.
Well, so the pay gap is essentially, is it women make 70% of what men make, generally speaking?
Yeah, it's women make about 72 cents. I've heard actually 80 cents. It's fluctuated depending on where I've heard it. And it's about around that to a dollar for men for every hour. That's basically it here in the U.S. We actually, it's sort of funny, not funny, but it's, I just have to laugh. I'm like, technically, until this year, we're like the number one superpower and all. And when you look at the World Economic Forum, every year they do like studies, basically we were below some like African nations like Namibia or something. But of course, some of these countries are a little bit better in those areas. But still, I'm like, we're like 22nd or 25th on that chart for pay gap. And when you think about it, the pay gap in general globally will not be diminished until like our grandchildren's grandchildren's, like it's at least a century or so away.
Only if they do something about it too.
Exactly. Right. Exactly. I think it's, we all have our voice. And I know at the end of the day, there's always that mentality. It's like, we have to be apologetic. We can't approach ourselves if we are applying for a job. Like statistics have said, like if a woman applies for a certain job, if we miss one of the five key things, we're like, we're not prepared for it. Whereas a man, if he missed three out of five, he's like, oh, I got this. Like, I'm just generalizing, but there's that disparity there. Like I would never go to a boss and say, if you don't promote me, I'm quitting. But I've heard of stories like that over the years, like where men would have the moxie to do that. So I think at the end of the day is to, the pay gap is definitely, and approaching corporate is definitely a touchy subject depending on what company you're in. I know Honest Company last year signed the White House Equal Pay Act. And I know other companies, definitely it's harder just because of the layers and such, but it definitely is the way to address this. I think it's to keep it in dialogue, but not just to be speaking about it, because I know after the one thing is there's so much dialogue of equal pay, but also in general, the whole women's, this whole movement of equality. But we have to be mindful because don't want to be that sort of the girl who cried wolf type of thing where we keep talking about it. And then when something happens, we're ignored or we're just totally ignored. Mm. So I think we have to be strategic of how we leverage that. And almost to the same time too, I hate to say this, I don't think we need to work harder or anything, but when we present it, I think, especially by nature, women are not, I know for myself, I know I need to look into negotiations more and how to negotiate to address this topic. I think that's the one thing as women, we have every right, if not more so, to be in these roles, to get the equal pay. But I think it's just trying to break those cultural stereotypes first, but it's going to be strategic. It's going to be how can we negotiate. There's a lot of factors, but I think we need to be persistent about it. And that's the one thing I'm here at my company. I keep bringing that up a little bit, or even this is going to be so random, but I was visiting a lot of different campuses last year and I would be in the women's loo. And all the time I would be like, please, hopefully this is not TMI, but I'd be like looking at their sanitary little distributions. All of them are free or in a basket or something. I kept sending to one of my friends who's working on other things here at this company. I'm like, look, it's free at IBM. It's free here. And little things like that, because even when it comes to taxes for that, but my company has that for free now, but it's little things. It's just trying, I think, being persistent, but just doing it in a way that's not going to bite you in the long run, where people are just going to ignore you because you're just that little gnat that keeps bugging them and not doing anything. Or so
I think the statement we had a little bit earlier in the show about speaking the language that makes sense would really help go a long way. Mm-hmm. And you can still say the same thing and try to get the same thing, but in a different manner. I do want to plug a book that I think
knew you were going to.
I love it.
It's called, especially because you mentioned negotiation, and I just love, 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 love this book. And I think every person should read this, but I definitely think specifically women and women who are ambitious in their career. It's called Never Split the Difference, Negotiating as If Your Life Depended on It by Chris Voss, who's an FBI, former FBI negotiator, talking to terrorists and all these kind of things. And it's funny because it's really kind of an exciting book because he has anecdotes of real life hanging in the balance kind of situations. But what was interesting, because this entire show, we've been talking about empathy and diversity and how empathy is one of the key things in negotiation, life or death or business, empathy is the key to getting what you want. And even if this person has a gun to your head and you might be angry or there might be certain extenuating circumstances, I love how the book kind of broke it down and tried to, even in difficult situations, got you to understand what the other person really wanted. So that main function of speaking the language that they understand gets you on their side.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. When you're mentioning that, it just reminded me, there's a side project I'm doing outside of work called Smash Stories. It's with a bunch of various female design leaders and all. And after one of our kickoff meetings one weekend, my peer, she was back in Dallas and talking to one of the VPs or partners of her digital company. And it's this older, upper middle class white man. And he's like, basically he was saying, why are you guys still complaining? You guys are equal, more or less. But at first she's like, oh Lord. But then she flipped the table or switched her seats and put her feet in his shoes. And it's like, he probably does not realize that he hears all these people talking about it, but doesn't really realize that. So she, to be able to understand and interact with him, she put on the empathy hat and it wasn't as mad. And she's like, okay, he doesn't understand because he's not exposed to everything except for what he reads in magazines or newspapers or hears on the news. So it's definitely approaching in a way, because I know when I started a women's design panel 2 years ago in LA, I had some male design leader from LA say, why do we need this? And other men were discussing about it because in the design field, 60 to 70% of the designers are women. But so people were thinking, oh, we're good. There's female designers. But no, when it comes down to it, it's in advertising, in design, there's like on average 11% are creative directors. So it is a discussion point, but because it's so prevalent now, a lot of people don't understand. They think it's fine because we're talking about it, but at the end of the day, a lot of these people aren't empathetic to us as women to understand what's going on. So in that scenario, we have to be empathetic to the other people to get anything done. So totally.
It also reminds me of continuing the concept or the idea of being empathetic and trying to speak to someone on terms that they can really understand. Mm-hmm. You know, when someone says, why do we need this? I think of clients who are like, why do we need this? Mm-hmm. You know? And so like Leia, when you're going through a design with them, because they're your client, you are kind of calm and professional and you're not taking it personally and you're trying to be empathetic to their perspective and you're right. explaining your design reasoning, you know, from that perspective. Whereas if someone's like, why do we need this when I'm talking about pay gap? I'm like, hey, don't be a dick. Do you know what I mean? Instead of being calm and professional about it, like it's also about managing emotions and recognizing what you're saying. Like not everyone is seeing what you're seeing. And I think that's very much like being a designer who's come up with some product or a design or a website or something, and you have to explain it to someone who doesn't quite get it.
So this reminds me of our episode with Amélie Lamont about fearless feedback. Mm. And I think we need to get to that point. And the one thing that reminded me of this episode was when she used to work at Apple, they taught about fearless feedback and assuming positive intent. Yeah. And I think in these difficult situations, while it's, again, my perspective is not everyone's perspective, I always feel like it's a tricky situation when you're a woman and a person of color. This doesn't mean I represent all women or all right. people of color. And I also understand, yes, it's a burden on us that we don't have to fix everything. But if you are speaking to a middle-aged white man, as Vanessa was explaining in that situation, who makes a comment that may not necessarily sound empathetic towards a particular situation, if you put yourself and assume positive intent, that helps you change how you may react. Right. Mm-hmm. Of course, not everyone has positive intent. That's a reality we have to deal with. But especially in the corporate world, and if you're trying to negotiate and you're trying to move up, and I think it's also a better way to live. I don't know necessarily if we're always thinking that this person's out to get you just because they said one offhand comment. That doesn't necessarily mean that's correct.
Very true. But as you're talking, one little like story I heard about was there's this woman who was pregnant and her boss or upper management said to her, like when she divulged that she was pregnant, it's like, oh, you had such promise. So there's been stories like that so much. So I'm like, when there was that older man who spoke to my friend, you know, yes, you could see where he was thinking, you know, he had the best intent because it's like, oh, there's discussion. Like, where is the, maybe when he started his professional career, there was no discussion about that. But then you throw in the factor of like, oh, but it's like, because I'm pregnant, I might be able to advance. Like you had promise. And like, there's that side. Like, I almost feel like it's C, like he may best intent, like where it might hinder you because you're going to have a baby, you might, but still.
Right. And that's tough to tackle because it's not up to that person who's pregnant to like correct them either. And it's not up to that person to not be offended because it is an offensive comment. But it's definitely a difficult thing to navigate around. However, you know, Emily and I had that conversation over how important it is because I'm not a perfect person. I've said things that were offside. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And what was important to me is that maybe because I was in a safe space and in front of my friends and also because they're good people, when/if I mess up, that they were able to correct me. And because I respected them, I took it to heart. I think that's the bottom line, right? Like if you have a genuine connection with someone, which means you actually both empathize with each other, like within friendship or family, if you say something offside or they say something offside, you feel safe in calling them out. You already automatically change the way you call them out too, because you know you don't want to hurt their feelings. And then if you are that person who did or said something wrong, you listen because you care and respect this person, right? So I want to put out that kind of perspective too, where, you know, maybe that comment was completely offside, but like, let's put another scenario where the person who said that was like your best friend and he was an engineer and it was a person who's never said anything really offside before, then just stating your perspective could help change his perspective, right? And I know it's happened to me, but, you know, again, I don't speak for all women or all people of color.
Yeah, I think it gets harder when you're in the workplace. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's such a different thing. I mean, it's true. If we could all find a way to treat each other with respect, like just, hey, let's be respectful to each other. That would be great. I think I came across a resource. I'll make sure we put it in the show notes. I haven't tried it. I often approach going into, because I work from home and I work by myself, you know, I don't interact with a bunch of people. So when I have to go into situations like that, I actually try to anticipate the worst scenarios because I've been there before.
Right.
And I don't know what to do when some guy makes an inappropriate comment to me who's not just socially, not at a bar, like in a conference with a fellow speaker who's being inappropriate to me.
Right.
And so I like to anticipate how I might handle those things where I feel like I've walked away with some dignity. Honestly, I could care less what they walk away with, but I want to make sure I walk away with a sense of dignity and not feeling like I often feel and can look back on situations where there has been sexual harassment in the workplace where I wish I had said something in the moment, but I was so shocked and embarrassed by what had happened. I just wanted to escape the situation.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So going into things was sort of like a prepared how I'm going to handle it if someone does this. And anyways, so this link that I came across says, sometimes you just don't know how to do that. And the simplest thing is to say, well, we don't do that here.
Oh, yeah.
I love it.
We don't do that here. Like, there's no judgment. There's no you're bad, I'm good, or women are better, or anything. It's just, well, that's fine, but we don't do that here. Thank you. And that's it. Right. You know, we don't talk that way to people here. We don't touch people that way here. Whatever it is, like, it's very simple, it's straightforward, and I want to try that the next time I'm in a situation, because there will be a next time.
Mm-hmm. What's interesting about what you said is, again, that reminded me of Amelie's episode, like, I guess, it's an episode on fearless feedback, and she was explaining an anecdote where there was a conflict with a coworker, and your explanation of you actually anticipate the worst and write out scenarios, that was actually what Amelie suggested, where she's like, okay, I'm going to sit down and write it down, down how I want to react, interact, and say in a way that's respectful before, instead of just jumping
reacting.
Reacting. Exactly. And then also that she entered that meeting saying, we're going to leave this meeting in a good mood, or we're going to leave this meeting in accord. Like, before they even started talking or even stating there's a problem, she stated that the outcome was already going to be good straight off the bat.
You know, setting the table in an appropriate way, I think that already sets the tone. So then we're all on the same page. Like, I know even too, I love those ideas. I think fortunately the team I work with, I don't have to encounter stuff like that as much anymore. But I did. I knew, like, the one-off conversations. I was once verbally threatened on the phone by this design leader, and I stepped back. For me, sometimes it's like my mother always tells me, three grounding breaths. Remember your three grounding breaths. Mm-hmm. So I didn't do the breathing, but I sort of just paused. And I think, just took a, sometimes it's also don't go, especially when you start feeling on the defense, it's a fight or flight, and you're going to jump into it and go quickly. But it's like, when you get in those moments, if you're not preparing, if you don't do the preparation, if that's not your thing, it's also too, remember, step back, pause, and then like what my response was just very cold, not cold, but very direct, and squashed it. And I gave the reasoning, and then the person like later in the conversation apologized, and I put the person in its place. Right. But still, it's like, I think, it's holding your own. Like Amelie, she held her own in the beginning, and that's what a man would do. And in my situation, that's what a man would do too. He would not, you know, so it's almost like, are you familiar with Pinterest Studios' new campaign, Write the Ratio?
No.
It was launched, I believe, August 23rd, the day before Women's Equality Day. And it's interesting. They have like Cindy Gallup a part of this, among other female design or especially in advertising leaders, and they have some interesting collateral. Like, I love the design, it's, and the board's been expanding, but they have some of these like terminologies. It's like WWWMD. So what would a white man do? and and like all these other other things too. It's, and I find it's a fascinating resource, but for me, it's like, what would a white man do? It's like Amelie would do what a white man would do. I would do it. Like, I hate to be generalizing, but still. So,
well, I mean, stereotypes exist so people can categorize things. And, you know, when you put it that way, it's, everyone has an instant reaction of what that means. Yeah. So,
well, I also want to caution though, that everything is context well too,
totally.
Because it's easy for someone to say like, okay, let me just literally take that advice. Mm-hmm. But if they're a marginalized person for whatever reason, behaving like privileged white person can have major,
makes you feel sick.
Well, it gives you major consequences, right? Mm-hmm. Because certain things, like even just like simply women, right? Like if you asking for a reasonable raise, even if you are asking for a reasonable raise in front of a female manager, can come off confrontational, right? And it's interesting. Like, I always find some of the advice about workplace inequality and pay gap things interesting, because I've applied some of that advice throughout my career with interesting varying results. Mm-hmm. You know, like, for example, the one thing that I'm thinking about, sometimes a lot of people try to talk about shifting the responsibility to the woman to lean in and do these things and just ask for the raise. And I remember earlier in my career, I actually typed out my resignation letter, kept it in my back pocket. And then when I was ready to negotiate my salary at that time, and I thought it was a fair raise. In fact, I remember seeing the salary sheet for my position, and I just wanted the high end of the initial position stuff because they initially paid me really low. And then I asked, this is what I want. They were like, no, we want to give you this instead. And I said, well, I don't think that's fair. And then they weren't willing to budge. And so I gave them my 2 weeks resignation right then and there. And my manager's face got so red. Like, he was so shocked. Like, he didn't expect me to actually give him a consequence for not giving me what I wanted and what I deserved. And then I quit. That's the thing. Like, if there's a consequence and there's a thing that you have to do, you have to follow through. Otherwise, it's, you know, it's meaningless. Mm-hmm. And this is kind of like the advice that men get all the time. Didn't work out for me because they didn't give me a raise and I ended up quitting. Mm-hmm. But that basically launched my design career. So, so, I mean, like, thanks. But at the same time, it's never a guarantee.
No, not in the least bit. And also, as you're talking about that, approaching the getting a raise and all, but even if you have like a male, doesn't matter if it's male, even sometimes the worst situations I've experienced and other female peers have experienced with female leaders, because they've gone through the whole rigmarole. So you have to go through it. So as you're talking about that, that just made me, like, in the beginning when you started talking, Emily, I'm like, ooh, I have to remember that, because it's amazing. Like, people having to take vacation days to go to a woman's conference, even though it shouldn't be a vacation day. It's just like those stereotypes. It's not just that, I know we keep saying men, but also too, it's, I think the whole, as a whole, traditional mindset in corporate America needs to be redirected too. And I know I've had sometimes the worst situations have been because of female coworkers.
We're going pretty long on this episode, so I want to start wrapping up. I do want to bring up a topic that we sort of touched on a little bit earlier, but I do think it's particularly relevant right now. Mm-hmm. It's about being strategic about whether we're addressing something for the corporation. You know, maybe we're part of a group for a company, or maybe we just want to address it for ourselves, where we're feeling there's some type of inequality that's keeping our quality of professional satisfaction low. Mm-hmm. How we can be more strategic about it, especially when I think we all can agree women's issues are really saturated in the media right now. Mm-hmm. And I have no problem with that. I'm saying that I think it kind of does get to a point of exhaustion for people who maybe aren't used to dealing with this on a regular basis. So how do we tackle these challenges without feeling like we're just part of a diluted message?
Right off the top of my head is bringing the men into the discussion. Bring the right people, who you, male counterparts or leaders who you know are empathetic and you can trust. Because once you bring them into the dialogue, that's where it can help sort of break down these barriers. So if I was going to go and, for example, like I don't have to deal with that this right now, but if I say wanted to go and get a raise, I probably would go right to one of my male mentors who I know I can trust and could help me give the right perspective. Or if I'm bringing a bigger panel or dialogue, I would bring men into the discussion. For the women's organization we have at Mattel, we have a annual conference. It's several hundred people go to it per year. It's always predominantly be women or women, even though men could attend it, which I think we're trying to encourage more. But we're actually doing a campaign this year. It's called, the theme is like Rerise. And tomorrow afternoon, I'm doing a photo shoot with different people from our company, but it's not just going to be all women. It's going to be men. So I think to sort of address this, like bringing people to come in to help the discussion, bring them on board so they could be empathetic. Or then once certain, if they see certain like leaders, male leaders might see certain men coming on board in this dialogue, that can help break down some of the barriers. But I think we can't go around in circles like a dog chasing its tail much longer, mm-hmm. but bringing the man, because a lot of times that's the issue or is to the dialogue is key.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, and I know everyone, I get the sense that a lot of people get really tired of men stating, well, you know, as the father of three daughters, I really support women getting paid equally. Yeah. You know, it's by bringing men into the conversation, by engaging with them, everyone, including women, can realize this is a people problem. This is not a women inequality problem, because it does affect men and families and communities. Right. When women don't have equal rights or equal access to resources or equal pay, that has a trickle-down effect to the community.
Well, to me, the bottom line is, again, if we're thinking about this in a business perspective or even in a project perspective, when we're trying to convince someone to implement a feature or do something, what we need to do is bring in the person who makes the decisions mm-hmm. and get them mm-hmm. on side. Mm-hmm. And the reality of our situation is that the people in position of power at this point in time in our society are men. And so if we are purposely excluding the people who have the actual ability to make systemic changes, then again, Vanessa, you were mentioning chasing our tail. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Oh, this is honestly, I could talk about this all the time because it's so on my mind these days, but we do need to wrap things up. Vanessa, could you recommend some resources for our listeners who want to know more about workplace inequality issues or issues like about the pay gap?
First and foremost, I think the one resource you should attack is or connect with, depending if they have in multiple cities, is Ladies Get Paid. They have a Slack channel that you have to join for free, the group, or join Ladies Get Paid, and you could be put on the Slack channel. It's international, very beneficial. And there's also most cities have chapters now. Beyond that, I think also if you're in the design field, look to Women Lead Initiative. It was started by Deborah Adler and Sue Matthews-Hale. And they have events, they have webcasts at times. And also different chapters do their own women's initiatives. And the one thing too, I find very fascinating, about 2 years ago, AIJ teamed up with the sociologist, Dr. Leah Arjaroglu, and created this gender equity toolkit to help break down, it's like a gamifying gender biases. So I have gender biases. So I think there's that too, that could be beneficial. I know we're doing a workshop with Linda Decker at our upcoming women's conference for this. There's that. And then there's, I would say, Pinterest. I love the Right the Ratio. I think that's something, I know it's, as we said, there's so much out there. I think for me, when I saw that, it caught my eye. It was a head snap, and bringing not the usual suspects to the dialogue. Yes, Cindy Gallup's there, but she's so refreshing, I find. But then there's other women. I'm like, who are they? And just how they interpreted some of the data, I find was fascinating. And on there too, there's actually a lot of resources too, I would say. So those are my top three things I would say right now.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
So that's all the time we have for today. But before we finish up, we've got our rapid fire 10 questions so our listeners can get to know you a bit better. Are you ready, Vanessa?
Sure.
Okay. First question, introvert or extrovert?
Extrovert.
The power is going to be out for the next week. What food from the fridge do you eat first?
Cheese.
What's your favorite website for fun?
Pinterest.
What's the last thing you read?
Scientific America.
What's the best piece of professional advice you've received?
One step at a time.
What's the worst piece of professional advice you've received?
You're not good at speaking. Yeah.
What's your favorite color?
Ooh, I guess red.
If you could take us to one restaurant in LA, where would we go?
Right now, I would say Factory Kitchen.
What kind of food is that?
Italian.
Mm. What's your favorite board game?
Trivial Pursuit.
And last question, Hulu or Netflix?
I'm biased, Hulu. Ooh.
So that's all the time we have for today. Thanks for joining the show.
Great. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
In case our listeners want to follow up with you, where can they find you online?
You can find me through Twitter and Instagram at VanDewCanDew. So VanDewCanDew.
Awesome. This was a really good conversation. Thank you for joining us today.
You're welcome. Thank you. I hope you have a great rest of the week. So thank you.
Control Click is produced by Bright Umbrella, a web services agency invested in education and social good. Today's podcast would not be possible without the support of this episode's sponsors. Many thanks to Craft CMS and Sidecar.
We'd also like to thank our hosting partner, Arcus Tech.
And thanks to our listeners for tuning in. If you want to know more about Control Click, make sure you follow us on Twitter at Control Clickcast or visit our website, controlclickcast.com. And if you like this episode, please give us a review on Stitcher or iTunes or both. Links are in our show notes and on our site.
Don't forget to tune into our next episode. Be sure to check out controlclickcast.com/schedule for upcoming topics.
This is Leah Alcantara
and Emily Lewis
signing off for Control Clickcast. See you next time.
Cheers.